I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 60 years ago, the Second World War in Europe came to a close with the unconditional surrender of Nazi Germany. Memorial celebrations have been held over this past week here in America, overseas in Western Europe, and again today in Moscow. And it's appropriate that world leaders gather there for, of the 50 million people who died in the Second World War, close to half that number were Soviet civilians and soldiers. Now, if we go back 60 years, VE Day is best recalled for the pandemonium in Times Square and, in the words of the great American reporter Edward R. Murrow, who found himself on that day in London's Piccadilly Circus.
They're jammed absolutely tight. A few minutes ago, a motorcycle went through, and there were four people on it, and now people are throwing confetti at me. I'm down on the sidewalk with a policeman here who is altogether inadequate protection. Incidentally, you may hear an occasional bang in the course of the next few minutes, but it's just effervescent people shooting off fireworks.
Today on The Connection, we talk with the men and women who are the living conscience of that time, the American soldiers who fought in the war and the civilians who supported them. Now, as the people who rallied together in this nation's sacrifice, they have become known as the greatest generation. But this is a generation that's now leaving us by the hundreds each day. We have two veterans in the studio with us, and we'll talk about what is lost when the storytellers themselves pass on. We'd also like to hear from you on the program. How are you marking the 60th anniversary of victory in Europe? How do you keep the memories of this conflict as a part of this country's living history? And what are the lessons that need to stay with us all? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'd like to introduce the people who are here in the Connection studio with me. Tom Matarazzo is a radio operator with 148th Armored Signal Company traveling all over Europe. He's here in the studio. Tom, it's good of you to join us. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Fran Murphy served in the Navy Armed Guard, spent his war years crisscrossing the Atlantic Ocean. Fran, it's good of you to come in as well.
Thank you for having me.
I'm interested just in hearing to start, if I can, from both of you about what it is that you were thinking about this past weekend. Fran, maybe you can start us off.
Well, going back 60 years, that's a long time. And I do think I was in New York at the time that the end of the war in Europe was announced. And I think every ship in the harbor began sounding their whistles the letter V, dat, dot, 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 dash. And I can remember somebody tied the whistle down, and we all went over the side down onto the dock and up to Times Square, which was a madhouse.
You got to Times Square
on
that day.
And really, you couldn't move in Times Square. There was a lot of shouting, yelling, screaming. And what I did was I went down to the Grand Central Station, bought a ticket, and came to Boston. So nobody knew where you were or what you were doing.
You came home.
Came home.
Was that a surprise for your family?
Yes.
Did they know you were nearby?
I just got back from Europe. They knew I was in town. I had called up.
Tom, you were in Europe on VE Day.
Well, yes, I was in Germany, and kind of an unusual, maybe a humorous experience, because a couple of days before the actual surrender, May 6th, as a matter of fact, we were stationed in the edge of the Harz Mountains, and the orderly room was situated up there. And as I was walking by, some fella comes running out and says, "The war is over. The Germans have capitulated." And so we were billeted in houses right around the area. And as the word got around, fellas were coming out of the houses onto the porches, and they bring their guns and shooting them up in the air. Now, Fran just mentioned about the ships using the V signal. In a sense, this is in their euphoric state. That's what these guys were doing. But the unusual circumstance was that, as I said, this was 2 days before the actual surrender. The Germans really wanted to surrender to the Americans, but I guess the political policy was that they should submit it to the Allies in toto. So, in the type of fighting that we had, when we moved forward into a town, We just took over houses. People were ordered to get out. If you think about that, you know, in your own house, somebody coming in and telling you you got 30 minutes to leave and you don't know where the hell to go. That's what happened there. But at any rate, the first house that we took in that particular area turned out to be too good because the general wanted it for his house. And speaking of that, when these guys shot off their guns, the bullets evidently were coming down where the general was. He wasn't too happy.
Just by accident, I would imagine.
So it turned out he wanted to know the name of everybody that shot off his gun. So the captain had no choice but he called a formation. And everybody who shot that gun stepped forward, you know, because they thought, you know, it's a natural thing to do. But would you believe the general ordered I guess it's a summary, the least of the court martials, and fined them a month's pay.
A month's pay?
Yeah.
And that stuck?
Yes.
That they were actually punished?
Yes. Although he stipulated no mark on their record, but nevertheless, however, you know, money really didn't mean anything over there because the tools of barter were chocolate or cigarettes. Money was just paper. It actually was Allied military currency. And that's what it was, printed by the Allies.
Was there ever any doubt at that time, Fran, that the war really had come to an end? Was there enough of a build-up that you knew when they called it that it was real?
Well, I was on the ship returning from Europe when the atomic bomb was dropped, the first atomic bomb was dropped. And we picked that up over the radio. We didn't know what an atomic bomb was. We just knew that this huge bomb dropped and probably Japan would have to surrender. And a couple of days later, we heard that the second one had dropped. And when we got into New York, of course, VJ Day took place. But we had no idea of the destruction to Hiroshima or Nagasaki. The greatest explosion, man-made explosion up until that time was in World War I at Halifax, Nova Scotia, in the collision of two ships, the Emu and the Mont Blanc.
Just about so flattened half the city, if I recall that.
It did. Yeah. And I was in Halifax during the war, too. The first trip I made, we had a collision off Halifax, and we went into Halifax, and we were in there for about 3 months, 3.5 months, being repaired. And I got to know all about the history of that explosion up there, and certainly I read enough about it up there. Even today, I get a Canadian ship comes in here, we go aboard the Canadian ship, and they talk about that. So the fact that the atomic bomb was dropped before we got back to New York, we were pretty certain that things were going to be over fast.
I'm interested. You mentioned that you still sort of stay in touch with the Canadian ships that'll come into Boston Harbor. How much both of you are still a part of annual get-togethers or memorials? How much does that still go on for the men that you served with, your company, your division?
Well, I don't know how unusual the experience was, but right after VE Day. We all thought that we were going to be shipped to the Pacific, and that was the natural order of things. As it turned out, just as Fran mentioned, the next thing we hear that there was this huge bomb that was dropped. Had no idea of what it was. And then a few days later, the second bomb, which led to almost the immediate surrender. So that changed things for us, and it turned out that everyone, of course, was very pleased that they wouldn't have to be going to the Pacific. But what happened was that they then started to break us up for the purposes of sending us home. Before that happened, our company got together and decided, wouldn't it be nice if we got together right after the war? And so we all threw in a kitty and entrusted three or four of the leading non-commissioned officers with the money, never knowing really what would happen.
Yeah.
But that was the start. We met the first year in New York. We met three more years after that. And then subsequently, I ran the reunions, and we held them for 47 years. And I really would have liked to have gone to 50, of course, But it turned out that a lot of the fellows who used to come weren't around anymore. And
so as the numbers got smaller and smaller, why decide to say, no, that's enough now? What was that decision?
Well, the reason was that the reunions were happy occasions when you saw these guys together. After a while, when each of your comrades was missing, it got to be like a wake. And
it's like who's not here rather than who is here, right?
So after the 47th year, what happened is I write a newsletter around now, but and as a matter of fact, the first week in June, there is a small contingent from New England that get together at Sturbridge in the public house, and we're going to be doing that again this year. So there's always that bond of trying to reunite with your old friends.
Connection listeners, when Tom Radarezzo came back to the United States, he went into the family business, but soon became Commissioner of Veterans Affairs, did that for 27 years for the state of Massachusetts. Fran Murphy became a history teacher, working his way up through the classroom. When we come back, we're going to start with Fran Murphy on the history, what we remember, what we forget, how we remember, particularly as we look at VE Day 60 years after that date. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. The 60th anniversary of VE Day, the end of the Second World War in Europe, has been celebrated this past weekend, and we think back to that day 60 years ago. It did bring to an end years of death and fear. It remains a moment also to mark the courage of all those who fought against the Nazis. Another reminder, as reported by Edward Murrow, the orders read out to all the Allied soldiers in the moment before the D-Day invasion.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force. You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio for this hour, I have Fran Murphy. He served in the Navy Armed Guard, spent his war years on the Atlantic Ocean. Tom Matarazzo, radio operator with 148th Armored Signal Company. Probably saw more of Europe in the period of time than anybody will ever see for the countries that he visited. Again, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to hear from you on how you're marking the 60th anniversary of VE Day and how it is we do remember. And I'm, Fran Murphy, going to turn to you on that because when you came back, you became a history teacher. And I mean, you standing in front of a classroom would be such a persuasive way of teaching people what that war meant. And I'm wondering if you allow yourself the time to think, gosh, and when it's not me and it's nobody who actually saw what happens then?
Well, you just follow the course of study that you're going to use. But you talk to the students about the places you went to. I went to Europe 6 times.
You were in the Mediterranean. You were in France.
Yes.
Yeah.
We worked out of the United States Navy Armed Guards Center, 1st Avenue, 52nd Street, Brooklyn, New York. And we'd be assigned to merchant ships.
This would mean there'd be like maybe 25, 35, 40 members of the Navy Armed Guard on each merchant ship, right?
Yes, that's right. They had the gunners. They had radio operators at first, and they were replaced by merchant marine radio operators as we went along. And we had signalmen. I was a signalman. We had 2 signalmen, which meant that you were standing watch 4 on and 4 off all the time you were at sea. And the break was when you got ashore, when ship tied up, they let the signalmen have free gangway. You could go and see what to be seen. The first ship I was on was the SS Charles Carroll. That was Liberty Hull No. 2. It was launched down in Virginia the day after the Patrick Henry was launched. The Patrick Henry got all the publicity. Charles Carroll did not.
Now, are we in 42 or 43 with
We're going back to 42 when it was launched. I got on the Charles Carroll for the third voyage. First voyage was to Europe. It was written up in Yankee Magazine. And the second voyage was to Brazil. When they came back from Brazil, they took the Navy crew off and we replaced them. And we ended up spending the winter in Halifax because of a collision in convoy. Convoys were very dangerous. When you take 60 ships and have to line them up out on the ocean someplace into columns, and this has never been done. Some of these captains resented, these merchant marine captains.
Well, what a target you were to have 60 altogether, right?
Yeah. But when we first went out, we were protected by the British Navy and the Canadian Navy. The United States Navy was protecting the route to the
And you were carrying bombs for the RAF as well
yes,
at the time,
we
right?
Yes, we did. We carried 525-ton... We carried 9,500-ton of bombs.
Sitting right on top of this. That was your cargo going
yes.
across, with German U-boats in the water, right?
And yes.
See, I'm going to go back to where I was, and Tom, jump in here, because you don't get that in a history book. You get that in a first-person story. Even as a history teacher, you got to agree with me on that.
Yes, I do.
And so where are we, Tom, when these storytellers are no longer with us, all, you know, of the whole greatest generation?
Well, when you mention that, there's human aspects involved also. We're talking about teaching. When we were sent overseas, for example, obviously they needed as many troops as possible. But that's what happened. As many troops as possible were put on a ship. Mm-hmm. And the actual practical aspects of that were that we were fed twice a day. I tell you, the ship we went over on was the George Washington Goethals. And I don't mind telling you, it was a stinking tub. The galley was midships down below.
Yeah.
And everybody on board got sick, and to the point where they would go down to try to put something in their stomach to have something
so they could
to throw up.
Throw up over the side.
Can you imagine
this,
that?
This crossing took how long?
It took us almost 2 weeks to get across.
That was about the length of journey,
Friend? 3 weeks.
3 weeks to
much slow. They had SC, slow convoys, and they had HXs, fast convoys. So troop ships would move much faster. But you didn't go straight over, you know. You zigzagged.
Yeah.
Same for you, Tom? It's,
yes, that's the way it is. You try to keep out of harm's way. And as it happened, we had a subscare going over, which wasn't too pleasant, but all part of what happens.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm going to take our first call from Raleigh, North Carolina. Bill's joining us on the line. Hello, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for the show. I enjoy it.
So how do you answer the question, how we keep those stories alive, how we keep the memory of that time alive, Bill?
Well, I've got a 13-year-old son, and he's a bit of a military buff, World War II, Vietnam War buff, and it's part of one of his hobbies. And as we travel around from place to place, if we run into World War II veterans, he'll go up to the veteran, thank them for their service, and then, you know, start a conversation with them about what they did during the war, what unit they were in, where they were in the war, and so on. And he's usually pretty good, so it usually turns out to be quite a long conversation and a good conversation. And the thing that's really surprising is that most of these veterans are very pleased that, you know, someone of his age, one, knows about the war and where they were, and it's taken the time to ask them. So he's gaining a lot of knowledge from that, and I think he's also, you know, keeping his hobby and interest alive.
I'm wondering, Tom or Fran, if you guys have the same experience where people will just say, tell me what you did in the war. I mean, does it happen less today than it used to before?
Yeah, every once in a while someone will do that, but it isn't as frequent as you might like to think. And probably because, according to the caller, and I appreciate the fact that he's saying that his son gets involved and is a little bit aware of that stuff. But that is not as prevalent as
yeah.
we would like.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's what I was thinking. Frank.
Yes, I've been interviewed by just recently two students, one from MIT and another one from Boston College High School. And they come with their tape recorders and they want me to talk to them about the war and what went on. And they seem very pleased to hear this, and they write it up and they get credit for that. That's going on now. We also have that project going on where some of the veterans organizations are interviewing veterans mm-hmm. and making tapes. These will go on record in libraries.
Bill, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
I'm just wondering when you hear Tom and Fran say it does happen, though perhaps not as much as it once did, is despite the interest of your son, is there a part of you that wonders how we will in fact remember 10 years from now, 20, 50 years from now?
Yeah, I do wonder. It seems you talk to a lot of young folks, they kind of blur history together in one short line. And, you know, without taking a look at the sacrifices that folks have made in the past and the reasons why we made those sacrifices, you know, we're kind of doomed to repeat some of those. So.
I'm wondering, though, in listening to, sitting in on your in the conversations that your son will have with veterans, what's he getting from those that he's never going to get from a book?
Well, he's going to get firsthand knowledge of what they went through, their feelings, you know, how they felt on the front line, how scared they were, mm-hmm. You know, what they thought of, how big they thought the picture was or how small they thought the picture was, you know, how the war affected them in particular. The one person that he's continually trying to catch and engage in a long conversation is my uncle, who was a medic during the Battle of the Bulge. And he only gets, maybe a 10 or 15 minute conversation with him every time that they meet. But what he gets out of
that... Is that because your uncle's reluctant to talk about that time?
He is reluctant to talk about it, yeah.
Yeah, I know, Tom, that you were close to the Battle of the Bulge as well.
We were in the reserve for that, yes. And my recollection was that up until that time, we had been kind of moving forward with a straight degree of regularity, so that the fact that the Germans were able to amass that type of force to launch an attack of that nature was really kind of a surprise. And for a while, it wasn't too pleasant until, as it turned out, the weather changed and allowed air support to come in, which I guess was the turning point of that.
This was mid-December. I mean, this was in some of the coldest
yes,
weather
was
that,
right
that you would have seen.
Close to the Christmas time, yeah. The Battle of the Bulge was, everybody has heard about it. Actually, it was Ardennes, but it's commonly called the Battle of the Bulge. But it also brings to mind, you know, for the likes of us to ask, when you read some type of history books and they tell you that we intercepted the German code and that we fooled them into thinking that we were going to invade France in a different place, well, when you really look at it, I hate to think what would have happened if we didn't fool them, because we had a tremendous amount of casualties on D-Day. So the Germans were a militaristic nation, and the fact that we were able to prevail largely, I think, was due to the fact that we had a bigger industrial complex and were able to provide supplies, which eventually they were not.
You know, it's the simplest, but also something that we lose sight of, that idea, Fran, that we know now because we were raised with the stories that the Allies prevailed in the Second World War. But I would imagine when you joined the Navy, that was very much in doubt at that time.
Yes, it was. What we had to do was build a tremendous merchant fleet, tankers and supply ships, and ship all of that wealth of America over there. It was the factories of America that were manufacturing the implements of war. And that's what these convoys are all about. With the Battle of the Bulge, Tom and I were very fortunate because we had a very good friend who passed away a few years ago, Sergeant Charles A. McGillivray, United States Army, Medal of Honor. He's a past president of the Congressional Medal of Honor Society. And he earned his Medal of Honor in the Battle of the Bulge at the French-German border. And he could pretty much, if you got him sitting down quietly, he could pretty much tell you what went on in the Battle of the Bulge. He lost an arm in the Battle of the Bulge. He was evacuated from the battlefield after knocking out four German machine gun nests, which prevented the Panzer units from coming down on his unit. And he became a patron for veterans all his life. He fought very, very hard for veterans. He worked in Boston here as a customs agent. And if you got Charlie McGillivray and George Street, these are Medal of Honor recipients that we knew, and Tom Hudner, and sat down with them, then you really found out how very, very difficult it was, particularly the Battle of the Bulge. When the Battle of the Bulge occurred, I was in Charleston, South Carolina. I just returned from the Mediterranean. And we had priority loading right away. I just caught the ship. I had 5 days leave out of Charleston, South Carolina. We went up to Norfolk, Virginia, and the convoy formed 120 ships. And we left Norfolk, Virginia, and we ended up in the Mediterranean. We ended up in southern France. And when we got to southern France, if you went to the port of Marseille and you tied up at the quay there, stone dock, and you looked as far as you could see were artillery shells unloaded from these ships, and they were loading them on the Red Ball Express of the Army, taking them up to the front.
Well, Connection listeners, Fran Murphy, Tom Matarazzo, Charles McGillivray, these are the people who tell us the stories of the Second World War. On this weekend, we're marking the 60th anniversary. We'd like to have you join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-TALK to Warrensburg, New York, for a call from Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Well, your question was, how do we remember?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, my dad is gone. My uncle is gone. My mother lost her first husband in the Battle of the Bulge. So as a child, I keep the memory alive for my children, because my dad was an engineer, and he went over to North Africa in November of 42, and he said they went into Morocco. They came down. They gave him water, and thank God he had his canteen, because they had painted where they had the water and put the water in the tank before the paint dried, and everybody got sick. And then he said for quite a while in North Africa, their equipment didn't work. He said that he lost a lot of his hair because he kept his helmet on, thank God, because there was a shot, and the shot went through his helmet, but he had a big egg on his head, but he didn't die.
Linda, can I just interrupt you for half a second and ask you? You say that you have these stories, and you make it your business to pass these stories along to your children. Can you at the same time convince them that they too have that responsibility to pass those stories along to their own children?
Adult children. It's, you know, my daughter was in France in Dieppe for the 50th anniversary, and so that she could say, "Yes, I'm walking the beaches." That not her dad, because her dad was her grandpa was North Africa, Sicily, Italy, Germany. He was there. Just was supposed to shake the Russians' hands and wouldn't because he didn't trust them. Then after VE Day, he went, got on a convoy, and went to the Philippines and was going to be the first group to Japan, probably would have been killed, and I wouldn't be around when they dropped the atomic bomb. So he was all over. So Allison was able to say when she came back, "Gee, Mom, I was there in June of 94, and I saw this and I saw that, and then I was able to talk to some people, and wow, it really hit home."
Linda, I need to stop you right there, and thank you for your call. We're talking this hour about passing along the stories, keeping alive the memories of the greatest generation. Here we are celebrating the 60th anniversary of VE Day at the end of the Second World War in Europe. We'd like to know your thoughts as we mark this anniversary. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. At the end of the Second World War in Europe, there were great celebrations and there was also great sorrow. It was only when the guns fell silent that people could assess the destruction of the conflict and the horror of the human cost, once again to the words of the reporter Edward R. Murrow, who was among those meeting the survivors of the Buchenwald death camp.
I could see their ribs through their thin shirts. The children clung to my hands and stared. We crossed to the courtyard. Men kept coming up to speak to me and to touch me. Professors from Poland, doctors from Vienna, men from all Europe. Men from the countries that made America. We proceeded to the small courtyard. There were two rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. Some had been shot through the head, but they bled but little.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. On this, the weekend, when nations around the world are marking the 60th anniversary of VE Day, we're asking you for your thoughts on that. We're going to take a call from San Francisco. David's on the line. Hello, David.
Yeah, hi, Dick, and greetings to your guests. I want to remember my Uncle Pat. He went through three different sieges in which they were entirely surrounded, and when they radioed in, they were given up for lost, and they survived each of them. Unfortunately, he made it until 1962, and then just the shell shock and delayed stress, he did himself in, and it was a real shock to our family, but we certainly remember him.
How was he at telling stories, David?
Beg pardon?
How was he at telling stories?
Oh, he wouldn't. And that was the horror of it. I mean, the one that they were able to drag out of him, he was riding along in a Jeep with the windshield down. As you remember, they flopped forward.
Yeah.
And he was sitting in the passenger seat. He had a bazooka in between his knees, standing straight up. And apparently they put a piano wire across the road, and the driver's head was cut off right next to him. And if he hadn't had that bazooka right in front of his throat, he would have also. So to watch the horror of war, to go through three sieges in which you're given up for dead by your own commanders, mm-hmm. That's the horror. But the reason I called, and this is this involves currently, Buchenwald and Auschwitz and all of these death camps, I've heard that the American public had no idea until they got to rescue these people that this was happening. Now we've got exact knowledge that this stuff is going on in Abu Ghraib, in Guantanamo. I'm wondering what the correlation is. Did these veterans have some inkling of what they were going into? Or I understand your guests, none of them actually went to these camps, but did they get word from the press? It's well known that Henry Ford and Prudential Life Insurance and GM and IBM and...
David, let's hear from Tom Matarazzo on that particular. You were in Europe. You were in Germany at
yes.
the time. What did you know about the camps then?
Well, initially, not that much. But as we moved along, we used to see people who were indentured to the Germans so that... the natural tendency of how Europeans waged war was that they would use slave labor. They would use captured people for the labor, where in America we would just pay people with the ordinary course of events. Especially, as it turned out, we find out later, the Jewish people and others were particularly mistreated. And when you mention that, right after the war, before we came home, one of the duties we had was guarding some of the captured German prisoners. And the enlisted men do the work and the officers supervise. So I remember talking to a German major, a very intelligent guy, and his comment was that he thought that the Americans should have joined forces with the Germans to fight the Russians. He figured communism was a big threat. And so I said, well, that seemed a little bit unlikely. And I asked him, what about the atrocities that were going on, especially with the Jewish people? And his answer was, well, we didn't know. And I was a little skeptical about that, and so I mean, really, can you really honestly tell me that? And his response was, well, if the tables were turned and the Gurk country was doing that, would they tell you? Well, I don't know. Would they keep it a secret or make it universally known?
You know, so, one of the things that I find particularly interesting about comparing that time to this time, and Fran, I'm going to ask you to help me with this one, is that we now consume news about what's happening all around the world almost in real time by all these cable television stations and radio and newspaper reporters who are around the world with satellite connections. We know in a moment what's happening, whether it's in a prison in Iraq. And at the time, in the Second World War, you said, yeah, we got information, but did you have to patch it together? Was it hard, really, to know what was going on or not?
It was very difficult to know what was going on. On board ship, you had radios. You couldn't send any radio. You could receive it. And all we were doing was getting information that the general public was getting. We listened a lot to the BBC, British Broadcasting System. In fact, we got the news of the invasion at sea. We were south of that area. And I can remember having to stand on an ammunition box and semaphore this information to the invasion fleet that was following the convoy along. And that's the only way we got information, was over the radio.
See, you spent years in high school and in college classrooms teaching history.
Yes.
And you'd be teaching this history to students who would, you know, be knowing exactly what's going on, thinking that they're knowing exactly what's going on in the world, and yes, trying to imagine their place back in the Second World War. In many ways, it's a different country today, I suppose.
Positively, communications is completely different. There was a lack of communications. You know, you found out after the fact. In fact, I came back to the States, tied up in New York, went up to Times Square, and for the first time I heard about Buchenwald. There were news films in the theaters, and I didn't know what it was all about.
Wow. 1-800-423-8255 to Bristol, Rhode Island, for a call from Mildred. Hi, Mildred.
Hi. Well, we have two connections with the war. My husband was in the Italian campaign as far as Anzio, and we make sure that our kids and our grandchildren our grandchildren are young, but they will understand everything about it. And but my father had worked at Burroughs Adding Machine Company, and was a skilled worker. And we lived in Detroit, you know, the arsenal of democracy. And boy, you can say that again. The Ford built the Jeeps, and the Chrysler plant built the tanks, and Willow Run was right there with the B-26s, and we saw the stuff going by all the time.
But you'd have also then been a part of an entire nation committed to a war effort.
It was a total commitment. I mean, even we, you know, go to the movies and buy defense stamps, and my mother would, put the fat in the can on the stove to save. And I mean, we did without, but no complaints. We just went through it. And to me, the story has not been written about the miracle. I mean, it was 4.5 years mm-hmm. that we did this. It seemed like a long time at the time, but every time I see a film with a ship going down or a Jeep being blown up, I think, my gosh, you know, that was probably built right here. Some guy I knew put the bolts in, you know. And it was, I think that has not been played up as much as it should be, because without that, without the good leadership and the entire war effort, we would have lost. And there was a time when we thought we were losing.
That's a part of the contrast that I think about when I, Tom, when I hear war stories today. It doesn't matter if we're talking about Vietnam or Iraq. The contrast between how the whole country was sort of one mind in the Second World War, and we've not seen that since.
No, that's exactly right. And, I like to refer to the first line of Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the worst of times because the entire globe was enmeshed in war. But it was the best of times because everybody in the country was unified and involved in furthering the war effort. There was we didn't reach the sophisticated age where we could question and protest at every decision that the government made. And, you know, Vietnam veterans have a particularly dislike towards a certain celebrity who spoke out against that war. But if you really look at the definition of aiding and abetting the enemy, it's called treason, which is serious, punishable up to death. So none of that ever occurred in World War II. And we had a universal draft, which meant that every family was either directly or indirectly involved. They had a husband, a father, a son, an uncle, a cousin who was in the military, so that everything that happened in the military, they knew about and were affected by. And if you compare that today with a volunteer army, that doesn't happen. It's somebody else who's out there fighting. And for the likes of the job that I'm in, which is to assist veterans, I'm particularly displeased at the fact that although the government is after another $80 billion for furthering the war effort, they're woefully weak in asking for money to assist veterans who have already served. And I've been appointed to a local advisory panel make suggestions on what they should be doing. But what they should be doing is considering the fact that taking care of those who have served is a cost of doing war. And that just doesn't happen,
unfortunately. I mean, it's a pretty blunt way of looking at what happens when the greatest generation passes on, Fran, that the people who would advocate for the veterans aren't there in the number to say, you know, these are the basic services that these people earn for their services to the country. I wonder if you see that voice. The voice itself is not as well heard as it was 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, you're correct in saying that. I'm very much concerned because Tom and I, we go to veterans' hospitals and we see the situation there and we see the bottom line financially that the reports indicate that the money's being cut back. And I think every veteran feels that the government of this country should support the veterans fully, particularly those who have been wounded. I think you can go down to Washington today into the General Hospital there and see the cases coming back, and they should be supported their entire life. They made the sacrifice for this country. Now the country has got to make a sacrifice for them.
1-800-423-8255. We're going to take another call from Rhode Island. This one's from Providence, and Sam's with us. Hi, Sam.
How do you do, sir?
Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate the effort to keep the stories alive. My father-in-law was in Scouts and Raiders in the Navy, and he was present in many battles, but he never told any of his children about what happened. But one day, when he came to visit me and my wife, he saw the Bill Malden print that I had up on the wall, and he asked me if I understood the joke. It was the one where they're digging foxholes on the beach, and one of them is saying, "I'm digging for turtle eggs, Junior," to explain why he's digging the hole. And I said, "Yes, I do understand the joke. Why would this guy ask, why are you digging a hole?" And suddenly he stopped for a moment, and he started telling me about what I think was probably the event that made him turn into a priest eventually, about when he was a navigator on an LST and was taking a load of wounded out from the beach after D-Day, and they hit a mine. And most of the wounded being carried in the LST because it flooded didn't survive. And I remember him telling me with tears in his eyes about how he had actually refused the Purple Heart that he had earned because he got wounded in the action when they hit the mine because he felt so guilty. And that was something when he opened up to me, just really sort of opened my eyes. And I felt there were so many stories he could have told, but he didn't. And he died 5 years ago, unfortunately, so a lot of the stories were remaining untold.
So how do those stories then, how do we keep the force in those stories that you deliver by retelling it as your father-in-law told it to you, Sam?
I think we need to connect with the people who are there, who are still with us. We need to find some way to get them, it's not so much telling stories, but it's a genuine oral history. I mean, we've had guys tell versions of it. Ernie Pyle, of course, told many of them. Bill Malden told many of them. There are many accounts of the Greatest Generation. But the more that we can get, the more we can understand how really great this endeavor was. And that's a book, isn't it?
I mean, not only just how great it was, but what we can learn from it that's relevant today, Fran. I'm sure that's an essential part of this.
I think so. I think that, you know, a number of veterans have written up short stories and had them published, particularly in the veterans magazines, but in other magazines too. And really, it's only in the last 10 years that they began to open up. I think World War II, the whole country was involved, and you felt that almost everybody else was as much involved as you were. And they had their own stories, but it's just recently you're getting these stories coming out, particularly in the veterans, the Legion magazine, the AMVETS magazine, the VFW magazine, that sort of thing. You're getting a lot of short stories that tell you an awful lot about what actually happened.
We waited a long time for those stories, Tom. I mean, maybe people not wanting to tell them and then realizing that if they don't, they won't be told at all.
Well, that's right. But as Fran mentioned that, we said before, everybody was involved. So it was the era of the citizen soldier. People really were civilians turned into soldiers.
Right.
And so as Fran mentioned, everybody thought that all they were doing was the same as their neighbor or someone else was doing. And so they never considered their experiences a story that they should tell someone because someone else had the same story. And so that's just the way they felt about things. Now, as you mentioned, unless some stories are told, the whole situation just passes on.
I want to thank you so much for coming in and spending some time with us.
Well, thank you for our invitation.
Thomas Matarazzo served as Commissioner of Veteran Affairs for 27 years here in Boston. And Fran Murphy, thank you so much for coming in as well.
You're totally welcome.
Fran Murphy, history teacher in high school and in university. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
That this heart and mind embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the chill.